4.6 billion.
The Earth forms.
Cambrian.
542 million.
Complex life explodes.
Permian Triassic.
251 million.
90% of species die.
Cretaceous Tertiary.
65 million.
Meteor kills the dinosaurs.
55 million.
Primates appear.
2.3 million.
Pleistocene.
200,000.
Humans appear.
20,000.
Agricultural
250.
Revolution. Industrial Revolution.
60.
Great acceleration.
The Anthropocene.
Generation Anthropocene, a program where we ask the question, what does it mean to be living in the new geologic age? I'm your host, Mike Osborne, and today we'll be featuring an interview with Terry Root. Stay with us.
Hi, my name is Rachel Monison, and I'm here today with Terry Root. Terry is a member of the Woods Institute, as well as the American Ornithologists Union. She was an IPCC lead author of the third and fourth assessment reports, a Defenders of Wildlife science advisor, and an Aldo Leopold Leadership Fellow. Thank you for joining us today, Terry.
It's great to be here with you.
So I'd like to start out by asking if you've heard of the term Anthropocene before.
Absolutely. Anthropocene, I think, is a fantastic word because it really sets in your mind the fact that humans are affecting the globe.
Yeah, some said it's like a paradigm change almost. Would
That's
you say
right.
that?
That's right. I really do think it's a paradigm change. It's making people realize that humans actually can affect the ground, the water, the air, everything. And it's something that people really need to be aware of because they're not if we don't tell them.
And where would you set the beginning of the Anthropocene, the boundary?
Oh, I really don't know where people set it, but since I work on climate change, the place where I would set it would be around the middle of the 1700s, because that's basically the start of the Industrial Revolution, mm-hmm. and that's when we really started affecting our atmosphere.
Now, you have said that ecology research was once done mainly on very small scales. How was your experience moving into some of the very broadest scales, climate across entire continents? You can't really get much bigger scale than that. How did you think to do that? How did your concepts of ecology develop?
Well, the project that I had to do for my ecology class at the University of Colorado was looking at the data from the Christmas bird count. And those data are continent-wide scale. And on the continent-wide scale, you can see different factors that are affecting species that you can't see on a small scale. And when I did my work, there was a man who did a study just as I was doing my work who said that 86% of the ecological studies were done with study areas that were the size of about two tennis courts put together. And here I was working on a continent-wide scale. Well, when you're looking at a very small scale, you can see the impact of competition, the impact of predation, the impact of biotic interactions. On a very, very large scale, on a continent-wide scale, you can't really see those, but you can see the effect of temperature and precipitation and things like that. So basically what I did was I followed the data. I also feel as though I'm a strong biogeographer. My father was a pilot, and we would fly all over the place, and I really, really, really enjoyed looking out and seeing this huge expanse, and I think that just predisposed me to being a large-scale type of scientist. But it was a hard road to go down at the time I went down it, because there were so few studies on a large scale.
How long did it take for those ideas to become more widely accepted? Or did they ever?
Yes, they have. They've become much more widely accepted. When I started doing my work, there was some work that was also being done by Jim Brown, who's an ecologist that is also a biogeographer. And he was more, you know, I was an upstart. People didn't know me, but people did know Jim. And so the work that he was doing, people were really respecting a lot. And so as soon as he started doing a lot of this, and then I was doing it, and there were a handful of other folks that were feeding into it, it really became much more accepted and respected. But there still is this group of folks that say the thing that is the most important in driving species occurrences, where they occur, is competition. And I'm not saying competition isn't important, but I think temperature is probably the most important to begin with, and then you put competition on top of that.
So speaking of research you've done and things that you promote that are a little bit controversial, I know that you're an advocate of prioritizing in conservation.
Yes.
And you've even used the term triage to describe how our decision-making process functions. Could you briefly, or however you want, explain that concept?
Talk about that. I work on how plants and animals are affected by climate change, and I kind of fell into it by my dissertation work. And what I have found is that in all of my work and in all of the work that other people are doing on this topic, I'm finding that we are facing a lot of extinctions in the future. And I, like many, many, many other biologists, believe that we are standing right at the edge of a new mass extinction. And mass extinction means that about half of the species on the planet will go extinct. And right now, we assume that we have about 10 million species on the planet. So that's about 5 million species. If it's even only a million species, which I think it will be a lot more than that, but even with a million species, we can't save them all. And so what we need to do is sit down and figure out which species to really work on and try to save. And so it's very similar to what happened in France during the war, when they had a limited number of doctors and a whole lot of injured soldiers. And the doctors, before they would go out onto the field, what they would do would be try and figure out the method by which they would decide which individuals to work on. So they divided them up into three different groups. One was a group that didn't need immediate treatment at all. They could wait for quite a while. They put them in one group. The second group was the group that had people in it that they could save them, but it would take them many, many, many hours to save them. And while they're working on those people, many of the other people would die. So they decided that a person that took a lot of time to work on to make sure that they would survive, they couldn't do that. They had to triage them and they had to say, we're going to make them comfortable, but we have to let them die. And then the other group was the group that they could work on and they could save in a fairly short period of time. I think the same thing now needs to go on for species. I think what we need to do is we need to say there's a group of species we don't need to worry about. But then there's this other group that no matter what we do, we're really not going to be able to save them, or we're going to put so much money, time, energy, effort into saving them that we're not going to have the time, energy, and effort to spend on other species. So I think we need to say we've got to let them go. And then we have to really concentrate on the ones that we do think we can save and that we need to save. And that's how I define my triage issue.
I think a lot of people would struggle with this idea because it feels almost like intentionally playing God or like giving up with ecosystems. How do you reply to that?
Oh, that's a tough one. And I truly am surprised that this is where I am right now. I mean, if you had told me even 5 years ago that I would be saying we need to deal with triage, I would tell you you were crazy, because I felt as though I was in this business to try and save the species that I could. But that's the issue, saving the species that I could. And you can't save everything. So is it playing God? It's more playing God explicitly than covertly. And if we don't think about it, we're still playing God. We just aren't acknowledging that we're playing God, because we really are causing the extinction of other species.
So you say that you were very surprised to see that you're advocating this now. Would you say that there's a time when you had a more idealistic perspective? Tell me about how you changed your mind. Like, what processes, what happened, what were you thinking?
Yes, there was a different time when I really thought that if we worked hard enough, we could save all the species on the planet. I truly believe that. I think the change occurred when I realized that we already were causing species to go extinct. We've lost a lot of species already. And if you look at what was actually causing those extinctions, it's been hunting, it's been habitat destruction. We have a lot of things that are causing species to be going extinct. I thought we could actually address those. But now that I'm working on climate change, you have climate change on top of habitat destruction and invasive species and the like. And you have species that are having to deal with all of these pressures, and it's just almost impossible to do that. So it was more of a realization as I learned more. As I learned more and more and more, I realized what humans actually are doing to the planet. And with life the way it is right now, we can't do anything but lose species. So that's just how it's going to end up, I think.
So it was a gradual realization over time?
It was a very gradual realization until all of a sudden one day I came face to face with the fact that I couldn't accept the fact that we could save everything. I mean, it really, there was a day that I had to flip over and I had to accept the fact that we can't save everything. There are things that are going to go extinct no matter how hard we work.
Was that difficult for you?
It was very difficult because I feel very strongly that there's an immoral aspect to what humans are doing to the world. And I think it is really wrong that one species, the human species, could be causing the extinction of half or over half of the species that exist on the planet right now. And it is a very sobering thought. And even if you look at it ecosystem-wise or human-wise and say, what species do we need to make sure we have so that the human species can survive, we still are losing species. And some of those species that we may need, we actually may be losing too. So it's a very sobering, it's a very depressing way to think about what's going on in the world. I mean, it's much easier to go to Disneyland and just say, everything's fine. Everything's not fine.
You mentioned that we may lose species that we need, but you also mentioned that it's immorally wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if you could expand on that a little.
On the immoral perspective?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I feel as though, boy, that's a hard one. I feel as though humans are a species and that species have lived together for millions, tens of millions of years. And there hasn't been one species that has really caused the demise of so many other species.
So back to the idea of triage. Different decision makers may have different priorities in which species need to be saved. Some may want to save unique species or ecologically important species or economically important species or charismatic species that bring in tourists. How should we balance all those things? Because one of them is, of course, practicality. But apart from that, like how can we say, okay, tigers or lions or whatever it is, you know?
Uh-huh. That's a superb question because I think it's asked by people almost every day. Let me tell you a story, and maybe that'll get this across. I one time gave a talk to all the directors of the zoos and aquaria in North America. And before my talk, there was a panel that was led by Julie Packard. And she had put in a program to try and save the 301 species of frogs and toads that occur in North America. And so what she did was she figured out if each zoo and aquaria kept three species, then we would be able to have a large enough populations that we wouldn't have genetic problems, and we would be able to have all 301 survive. So she got up first and talked about this, and I thought, God, that sounds fantastic. You know, she's done a really good job. And then the first panelist started talking, who was a zoo director, and he said, Julie, this is a great program, but it's costing me time for people to actually be dealing with the frogs and toads. It's costing me energy to heat the area. It's costing me infrastructure to take up that type. It's taking me money to feed them and to pay for the people to be in them. And nobody in the public really cares if we have three species of frogs and toads. So here she had implemented this program, and it really wasn't working. So then I thought, okay, that's just one person. Let's wait and see what the other panelists say. And what happened is the other panelists came along and said basically the exact same thing. So here is an example where you have one person that puts a program in place and gets it going, and then all of a sudden it's just not working. and so it has to be disbanded. I had a graduate student who worked at a zoo for a while, and she said every time you get a new director in, that new director decides which species he wants to be working on and which species he doesn't. And if he doesn't want to work on those species, then they take those animals and ship them to some other zoo. So there really is this change that goes on in the small microcosm of the zoos and aquaria. The same thing is going on in wild species, too, because you have different projects that are saying, we can save this species if we do this, and then somebody will come in new and say, wasting too much money. Let's cut that one and put the money over here. And then somebody else comes in, let's cut that money and put the money over at a different place. So it's tough. What we're talking about is a problem that there is no easy solution. And we've got to somehow sit down and come up with a list of species that we really do want to work on saving and try not to change our minds. But of course, we have to change our minds as we get more information. But let it be due to more information, not due to the whimsy of whoever's working on it.
Considering how we don't know everything about ecosystems, do you think it might be a gamble to assume that we can just know which species are best to be saved?
That is such an important question. We truly do not understand ecology completely, and we can't. We can never understand it all. So if we lose species X, does that mean that species A, B, C, D, and E are going to go too? We really don't know. And the thing that is important with global warming is that the species are going to be moving all in separate ways. What's going to happen is we're going to be actually disrupting all the biotic interactions that these species are used to having. And when you start disrupting biotic interactions, things like competition and predation, you can actually cause the extinction of species just by doing that. So there's a lot we don't understand, and what we have to do is we have to understand as much as we can. Are we going to make mistakes? I guarantee you we're going to make mistakes. There's no way around it. But we can't be frozen into not acting just because we're worried we're going to make mistakes. We're going to make mistakes. We can learn from them. Let's go ahead and learn from them and try to actually save some species. But we will never know everything we need to know about the ecology of species in order to be 100% sure we can save them.
Which species do you think are most important to save?
Oh, that's a tough one. You can start and do a list of saying what are the charismatic ones, because those are the ones that most of the public are going to be interested in, and they'll go along with what you're trying to do. There's the ones that we need to have around, like pollinators to pollinate our crops. We've got to save those. We've got to save the ones that actually help clean up the mess that we're making, so that clean our water, clean our air. That type of thing. I think we have to do all of that. And we've got to save the species that if you lose them, a domino effect occurs and a lot of other species go extinct just because you lose those. So there are many, many species out there that if you save one, it's going to actually save more than one. And I think those would be a good place to start too. Another group that I would like to save are the ones that are very unusual, like nobody cares about the tuatara, which is a lizard down in New Zealand, but it is a very, very, very unusual animal. It has an eye on the top of its head. It is very unusual, and I think that species like that are quite valuable also.
So do you think that educating the public is likely to cause behavior change or just a sense of hopelessness? What is the right balance of optimism versus disaster message? A lot of people have criticized the environmental movement for being kind of doom and gloom.
That is a superb question, because I ask myself almost every day, how much do I say and how much do I not say? I have a lot of hope. If I didn't have a lot of hope, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing. It's a very, very depressing field to be in. But I truly believe that the work that I am doing is going to help to save a lot of different species, and we've got to have them saved, and we've got to work on that. There are people who say, don't sugarcoat it, because if you sugarcoat it, people aren't going to realize how dire it is. And then there's people who say, don't tell people how dire it is, because then they're going to be paralyzed and not know what to do. I honestly don't know what the right thing is. And what I do is I try to figure out each time when I'm actually giving a talk or talking to people, trying to figure out which is the best way to go. And I talk to people a lot saying, what did you think of the talk I just gave? Was it too extreme? Was it, you know, the main thing I never do is I work very, very hard at trying not to exaggerate, because the truth is bad enough. You don't need to exaggerate at all.
So, have people criticized you for engaging in advocacy? I know that's a big question.
That is a big question. I believe strongly that all scientists have a right to advocate, because I'm also a human and I have my own value system. What I don't think is appropriate is that you let your values get inside of your science. You want to have your science as free of your values as you possibly can. Can it be totally free? It can't be totally free, because I pick the things I work on because of my values. I don't work on something that I don't believe in. So that's a value system at the very beginning. But I work hard at keeping my values out. So when I'm advocating, what I do is I basically say, I'm taking off my scientist hat now. I'm putting on my human hat, and here are my values. I think that's the only way you can do it. And I think scientists are valuable advocates, and we need to take advantage of what they know.
So with communicating to the public, what do you think is the most impactful change that people can make in their own lives to affect or head off the worst consequences of climate change?
I think right now, well, hold on, let me step back a minute. What we have to do to really change what we're doing to our climate is to get ourselves off of the fossil fuel addiction that we're on right now. So anything that we can do to try and stop that, we should do. Now, there are people out there that if you say change their light bulbs, they're going to see that as being trivial. But there are other people out there that think, oh, should I really change my light bulbs? It's actually getting them to start thinking about it. So to say, don't just tell people to change their light bulbs. Well, some people, that's a way to start. We've got to get people to start thinking about this. And the best way to do that is to just sit down and say, where is most of the carbon coming from? And let's work at trying to reduce the amount of carbon that we're putting into the atmosphere. If we can do that, however you do it, you do it. If you are an entrepreneur and you can help fund research that is getting us off a carbon diet, then that's what you do. If you're a student and you don't have the money to do that type of thing, maybe what you do is you put your refrigerator into a green plug so that it doesn't use as much electricity, or you figure out how to run errands so that you pack them all together. You run five errands at one time instead of one errand five times. Those sound trivial. They're not trivial. It's getting people to understand how important it is.
So how do you think the current public perception of climate change is right now?
I think it's very political, and I think it is very, very sad. Because if we would start now, we could save a lot more species than if we start in 10 years from now. If we could just start and really work on things, it would make a big difference. I think the most important advice to give anybody is to not give up. The desire to give up is pretty strong, and I feel it all the time. It's a very, very depressing question that we're working on when we're talking about the Anthropocene. Humans are messing with things that they don't understand, and there's going to be a lot of trouble. And when we have a lot of trouble, that's going to say, oh, maybe we should stop. Maybe we shouldn't do that. We can't do that. We've got to keep going on. Just like I told you, Rachel, is no matter what we do, we're going to make mistakes. That's part of life. Accept the fact that that's part of life and keep plugging along and keep making the mistakes, because in amongst those mistakes are going to be priceless things that the world is going to need. And you've got to keep doing those. You've just got to.
So what's next for your future?
Oh, my God.
I don't mean what do you want to do with your life. I mean, what are you thinking about? What are you hoping to do?
I like teaching.
Awesome.
I do. I don't think I'd want to be a professor, though. I'm not sure. I just know that I like sharing what I know with other people.
I know what you mean. And I struggle with that a lot because I love teaching. I'm not sure it satisfies my ambitions. You know, like I am idealistic. I do want to change the world.
And
how big of an audience am I reaching if it's just a classroom, you know? On the other hand, I have a friend who he's in education, and he struggles with some of these same things. And one thing he said to me is, you know, you can't underestimate how great it is to see progress on a day-to-day basis, like to watch that happen every day. That immediate sort of the gratification of teaching is a powerful thing and really can sustain you, can satisfy some of that life ambition stuff. Well, Rachel, thanks so much. It was a real pleasure having you in class, and well done on your interview.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Generation Anthropocene. We want to thank all of the students and subjects who contributed to this project. And you can find the full-length interviews at our website, stanford.edu/group/Anthropocene. Thanks to Maserati for letting us use their song Monoliths. A very special thanks to co-producer Tom Hayden for feedback, guidance, and inspiration. Thanks also to Julie Kennedy in the Earth Systems Program. And thanks to KZSU Studios Stanford, where all of our interviews were recorded. History is accelerating, and you're a part of it too. Where would you draw the line?